This is Marion Haberly interviewing Jonathan Warner at his home in Lion's Head. It's December the 3rd, 2001. And Jonathan, your full name is?
Jonathan Scoville Warner.
Uh-huh.
I was named after my great uncle, Jonathan Scoville.
Oh, yes, yes. So you have connections in two families.
Two families, and I think both of my great-grandfathers were born in Salisbury, which astounds me.
Well, your roots go way back then.
No, yes. They stayed around.
Yeah. When were you born?
I was born May 29, 1924.
Uh-huh. And you were born here in...
Actually, my mother had lived a lot of her early life in New York with her mother in New York City. So I was born there at some lying-in hospital. My grandmother was living down there in New York.
Uh-huh.
So my mother went there. At that point, the medical facilities here were not too much.
No. I see.
So actually, I was born down there.
Mm-hmm. And who were your parents?
Well, my father was Donald Judson Warner. He was a Salisbury native, born in 1985, I forget the exact day right now, June 21st, I think, or July 21st, 1985. My mother was Lois Church Scoville. I think she was born in either Buffalo, New York, or New York City in April 1985. So they were both born in the same year.
And then your parents lived in the house that was Bushnell
Tavern, right, on the corner of the, across from the library.
And your siblings were?
I had an older brother, Donald, who was born May 13, 1921, and a sister, Lois, who was born in May 28th, 1922. She was 2 years older than I.
Oh, I see.
And a younger sister, Frances, who was born on October 14th, 1926. So she's 2.5 years younger.
Uh-huh.
And Lois and Donald are both deceased. And my sister Frances now lives out in Minneapolis. Doesn't get back here very often.
Mm-hmm. For how long then did you live here in Salisbury?
I grew up here. I mean, I was just born in New York and then came back here probably at some young age. And that year, my parents, having three children, decided to add on to the old Bushnell Tavern. So they added a wing in back. I think they were living at that time, and while the wing was being built, they were living up in the what was called the Gray Cottage, which is on the road up to Hamlet Hill. It's with a house on the right there. At that time, it was the last house before the end of the road. The end of the road was a brick house where the Ram family lived. The Gray Cottage was the next one down the hill.
This road that I'm interrupting you, I'm sorry, that's Prospect Hill Road, isn't it?
Yeah, it was Hamlet Hill Farm, Prospect Hill Road.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to...
Yeah, so that was I think I may have lived there the first few months, and then after that I lived down in Main Street in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm. So your childhood was spent here in Salisbury, and did you go to private schools or the...
Yeah, the first school I remember, I'm not sure I really remember, it was Mrs. Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T, who had a school down on the Salmon Kill Road, as they call it now. It's on the, you know, where the village associations are.
Mm-hmm.
The health center, the health visiting nurse and stuff. It's, and there's a Dark Hollow Road goes off to the right after that. And then on the next corner on the left, there was a Mrs. Stewart lived. And she had a little school, sort of a kindergarten, I guess. I remember going there, but I don't remember much about it. I must have been when I was pretty young.
Yeah.
Then there was a Mrs. Tracy, whose husband, Jack Tracy, was a math teacher in Hodgkin's. And Mrs. Tracy had a school in that big old yellow brick building facing the tennis courts, which used to be the entrance, the only entrance to the campus was in that way, in that building. But she rented a couple of rooms, I guess, from the school and had a elementary school there. Mm-hmm. So that's where I went from, I guess, from probably first grade through, I'm trying to think back the other day. I think I was there until 19. I started school, I believe, when I was 5, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And I was there until age 10. And I went to Indian Mountain School.
Mm-hmm.
So the schooling of various kinds was there. I had a lovely time at Mrs. Tracy's school. We were always, there were a lot of naughty little boys there. We were.
It wasn't just a boys' school.
No, it was just a little day school.
It was co-ed.
Co-ed, and maybe, I don't know that down there more than it does, but it was 15 maybe. And there, some of brother and sister.
Uh-huh.
John Martin was a great friend of mine. His family is an old family around here. Somehow hooked him with the Belchers. But his mother was a widow. I don't know whether his father died sometime. And Mrs. Martin, later Gretchen Martin, she later married Carly Fleischman and lived in a brick house up on Wells Hill Road on the left-hand side. I don't know who lives there now. After that, it's now pretty well hidden behind trees. It's got a lovely view looking north across the valley.
Uh-huh.
And John and I were great friends.
Yeah.
That would be terrible there in school. All sorts of mischief.
Yeah. Yeah. Just...
Yeah, that house was... I don't know who it is now, but it's that brick house. Just at the top, the first major house on the left after you leave.
Uh-huh.
Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Hill.
Yeah.
And John had an older sister, Nancy. And mm-hmm. They were both a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I was 10, I went to Indian Mountain School, which was a weird school, in a way. It was over on, it still is where it is, but it was, at that point it was just a boarding school. And there were just boys. It was run by a man named Francis Bain Riggs, B-E-H-N, whose brother was the psychiatrist, Austin Riggs, who ran the psychiatric hospital in Stockbridge, the Austin Riggs Center, which is quite famous in the psychiatric treatment. But Francis Bain Riggs was really a character. About 6'4". He wore knickers all the time, and he'd been sort of a baldish with sort of a fuzzy brown hair. Looked sort of like a gorilla or something with long arms and head down. He was the headmaster. He had a daughter named Lorna, whom the boys all called Forlorna. And he had a son, Austin, who went to school there. So the school ran much better. Mr. Riggs went to Florida for the winter, as he began to do. he was trying to run it on somewhat of a model of a British boarding school. He lived in physical discipline for the boys, including mm-hmm. strapping with a belt for misbehavior. And yet he was an ardent pacifist. At that point, he used to go to New York to march in some sort of a pacifist parade.
Uh-huh.
They all wore green or something. This was must have been back in the early mid-30s.
Yes.
And so, but then Louis Schutte came up from Cornwall. And I think he'd been on the faculty of the Cornwall School Academy or something. And he came up
mm-hmm.
with was a temporary headmaster. But anyhow, Indian Mountain School was fun. John Martin went there too. Oh, some other boy, George Emery from Sharon. I think he maybe still had his sister, Adelaide, living in Sharon. But anyhow, did she? Okay. His father, John, George's father was an insurance executive in New York. And they were, I can't remember a lot of the other, a lot of, I remember still a lot of names, not too many local ones. So. That was time when the, we got, remember one winter there, for example, when there used to be an underpass on the railroad leading to Hotchkiss. The old railroad line came in just off Route 44, where the Indian Mountain Road went under it there and then went down the hill. I remember one year that railroad underpass filled up with snow, and they had to get, in those days they didn't have a lot of bulldozers and things, and they had to really pretty much dig the whole thing out. Meanwhile, the cars drove around and cleared the space around the underpass.
Yeah.
That was
interesting.
Going back a little, I'm sort of going to leap around and say, one of the things that we got into very much was skiing at a very young age. I don't know how this occurred, but my father, I think maybe, got to know John Seyfried of the Norwegian family. John was had been a Norwegian Olympic skier, and he moved to Salt Creek. And then his whole family moved, his mother and his two sisters, Charlotte and Ingrid, Othar, Sparrow, Magnus. So was it.
Go ahead. You were speaking of the safety.
Skiing was something that I remember. I started skiing, I think, at about the age 4 or 5. And there was a little hill across from us that went up along the graveyard, or just above the graveyard, and came down to that strip of lawn that goes down to the town hall. And we had a little jump there that we made out of piling up snow to make it, packing it out, make it jump. And we could jump maybe, I don't know, 10 feet or something like that. Very early age we did that. In those days, it was had a toe strap and a rubber band. Rubber band was just a cut out of a piece of inner tube.
Yes.
And the toe, and it went under the toe of the boot or galoshes where they came through the toe strap, then around the heel. So it gave it. But we started there, and then I don't remember this from direct memory, but it was I think the first ski jumping competition or event in Salisbury was held out back of our house. Wacacastina Brook or Wood Creek or whatever they call it now. It had at one point had a much wider floodplain and creek bed. It had been gouged out. It was a fairly steep bank on the other side of the brook from our house. And a hill behind that went up to a meadow where there was a little cabin in the field. And they built it, figured it out so the jumpers could start on the top of the cabin, slide down off the cabin roof, and then go down through a little ways, across a field, and through a little patch of woods, and then to this jump at the edge of this steep lower incline. That's where they had the first jump. And then as it came off the jump, came down a steep incline, and there was a little flat stretch where they could stop. So that was a very rudimentary kind of jump.
For how long did they continue to do it there?
I don't know. I think I was very young at the age that was going on. Then they began doing it down at the present location, which is some land that had belonged to my grandfather. My grandfather, Judge Donald T. Warner, was had been a lawyer here for a lot of years. Like a lot of lawyers, he'd ended up with scraps and bits of real estate. I don't know, he probably took out his bills or he knew something was going to come on the market. But anyhow, he had a lot of odds and ends of land. And of course, back in the early days of town, a lot of people owned land. They had woodlots for the chopping firewood. But anyhow, he owned that land from all the way. He owned the stretch now where the visiting nurses, that meadow, which is sort of directly back of his house up on yeah. Main Street. And then he owned across the brook, a place they call Indian Cave, which is a really sort of a shelter under the rocks on the hillside. And he owned down beyond that, down to, there was an old road that had gone down through there. There's a bridge at the bottom of that meadow. If you went out back from the town, headed east, there was a bridge. And if you went across the bridge, that would have been Forebrook coming down,
mm-hmm.
and turned right, you could follow the thing that went along in the base of the hill there, all the way down to Salmon Kill Road,
mm-hmm.
where the Ingersolls lived. Colin and Marie Ingersoll. Colin Ingersoll was a civil engineer, and Marie was a relation of ours. Everybody's related around here. I think she was a Harrison. Harrison, I don't know how the Harrisons were related to me, but they were. But anyhow, so we used to walk down there. We loved to walk down there. On Sunday afternoon, my parents loved to take a walk. They'd grab all of us kids, we'd take off, go walking down there for a Sunday afternoon walk.
Huh.
And in 1929, we were walking down there in May one day, and we came, we were walking back, and we looked across the valley, we could see smoke coming off Mount Rigor. It was a terribly dry May, and there was a forest fire. I remember my father getting very excited and disappeared for a few days. There was like a great excitement, this fire and stuff. And he'd dress up with his old clothes and they'd go up on the mountain and fight. Of course, those days they didn't have bulldozers. They'd cut fire breaks if they could, and they'd set the backfires, but that was a terrible fire. It was started by a steam locomotive over on the Harlem Division of the New York Central. It came right up over the mountain, came all the way down and hit the hit Route 41, hit the other mountain road.
Yeah.
It just...
Did it involve your property up there? Because
yeah,
you had property up there.
But it was the property up there, but you have to realize that property had been clear cut several times to provide charcoal for the iron furnaces. We talk about the clear cutting out west, and around here was just horrible. They clear cut, they make charcoal,
mm-hmm.
charcoal
mm-hmm.
pits and stuff.
Yes.
And that, my grandfather, Donald Judson Warner, had gotten involved that. He had a little piece of land up there. I think he had a little fishing camp that he owned himself individually. A little piece, 5 acres or something, with a cabin on it. But the rest of the land where there'd been the old, this had all been forest land owned by different iron companies.
Yes.
And the Millerton Iron Company was the last owner. And that went broke. And my grandfather and a couple of other people bought up the land after the Iron Company went broke, and that land was practically worthless at that time. Mostly scrub oak, it had all been cut over,
mm-hmm.
and forest land like that was a dime a dozen, because all the furnaces had gone broke, the demand for charcoal disappeared,
mm-hmm.
and they cut off all the trees anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked up about, I don't know, something over 4,000 acres
mm-hmm.
of ledgy mountaintop.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a terrible fire, though.
Yes. It came up in another interview with a family who lived up around in the Lincoln City Road area, and they one of the women mentioned it in her.
Yeah, because Julia Petit used to live up there on Selleck Hill, and her grandfather or something, or
he was
the last iron master.
That's right.
I never knew her.
Right.
She's very
old
lady.
Yeah.
My father didn't think she was too reliable on some of her history, but he was pretty critical of me.
Well, tell me about yourself. When you finished it at
well,
Indian Mountain.
Well, I was
going
to say, one of the things I love to do at Indian
right
Mountain
ahead.
Is ski. And we have a little ski jump there, and I love
oh.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Indian Mountain School sort of fell apart, I think, because of Mr. Riggs' personality, maybe. So that's just my reconstructing. And I don't know why, but John Martin and I, among other people, got pulled out. And so we didn't go back for our senior year, our eighth grade year.
Uh-huh.
I was sent for 1 year to a school called the Harvey School, which was down at the traffic circle in Hawthorne, New York, where the sawmill and the
yes.
whatever the
you know,
other.
The area, yes.
But it was at that traffic circle. And it was run by a guy named Carter, whose brother lived up here in Taconics or anyhow. I got sent there for a year, and I hated that because I didn't know anybody. So that was sort of a lost year.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came back and went to the Hotchkiss School where my father had gone. My father must have been one of the early classes because he graduated from college in 1906. So.
Yes. When you went to Hotchkiss, were you a day student?
No,
or
I was not a day student.
Boarding.
I think my mother, probably my mother, was very glad to get rid of us at that. She sent my brother to, he went off to boarding school earlier than I was up at St. Paul's School. My sisters both went down and lived with their grandmother in New York City and went to the Brearley School, which was a, at that time, one of the good girls' day schools.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd spend the winters down there with their grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and father would have nobody at home, because mm-hmm. I think pleased them.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Hotchkiss was, my brother had gone to St. Paul's. Hotchkiss was sort of by default. I didn't really have much choice in the matter. I had no reason to like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle, John McChesney, taught there. Then. He was married to my mother's sister, Molly Scoville. And so that was part of the reason.
Mm-hmm.
Hotchkiss was a good school. That's so different from now. Big old main building with yellow brick with sort of creaky wood floors.
Uh-huh.
And Greek statuary or busts along the side of the corridor.
Uh-huh.
It's very kind of plain and simple and not very
uh-huh.
not very fancy. But academically, I guess it was very good. I learned a lot.
Yes, yes. Do you remember who the headmaster was?
Oh, yeah, George Van Sanford was the headmaster then. And I got to know him slightly because, even as a young person, because he and my Uncle John kept horses up there, had some stables up there by the, before you get to the school on the left there where the garage is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go riding with them occasionally,
mm-hmm.
those two. So.
Yeah. After Hotchkiss, then, did you stay here or go off to school?
I went to Yale, like all good little Connecticut boys. Hotchkiss was a prep school for Yale.
Yes.
And I sort of vaguely thought of going to, Harvard at one point, but it was sort of overwhelming when 80% of your classmates were going, but all my friends were going.
Mm-hmm.
So I got there in the fall of 41, just before the war started, and had a very kind of confused college life.
Yes.
I was in something called the B-12 program, which was an officer, not an officer candidate problem, but sort of my way of draft, or getting kids signed up early
mm-hmm.
with the idea you stay in college, they'd let you graduate, then you go into the service and
mm-hmm. yeah.
go to OCS. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, for some crazy reason, I met one of my friends one day, and he's in the spring of 42, and he said, well, I'm going over to check out the Marine Corps recruiter here is up for the Navy B-12 program, and I'm going over to check it out. You want to come? So I was nothing else to do that afternoon in the spring. And so I went over there with him and talked to the guy, and we both decided to sign up. And he flunked out because of bad ears or something, but I got signed up very unknowingly with the Marine Corps. At that point, I knew nothing about the Marine Corps. I thought they sort of served on ships. I didn't really know there were World War I history of some terrible trench fighting in France. Well, anyhow, that was.
So you stayed in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I ended up getting a considered college, getting through college in 3.5 years, going into the active duty of the Marines, spring of 44, and then went to Paris Island, then went to OCS down at Camp Lejeune, went out to the island of Guam, where I was in training for the invasion of Japan when the war ended, which I was very thankful.
Thank goodness.
And I spent a couple of months in China later on. I think we were in China maybe as a token force to discourage the communists from taking over around Peking. It wasn't a huge force. Mm-hmm. It's funny because I ran into Lakeville Boy when I was out there, Hugh O'Neill, who was a classmate of mine from Hotchkiss. And Hugh had ended up the Stars and Stripes newspaper in the Army. He was a sergeant.
Oh.
He came up to Tinsin, where we were, where Jim Robinson, my old college roommate, Jim Robinson from Toledo, was there too, showed up in Tinsin. So we remember Hugh took us out for dinner one night, and he could speak Chinese, so we had a gorgeous Chinese feast. That was just funny running into him.
Yeah. And then what did you do after the service? You mentioned before something about a psychologist.
Well, that comes a while. That'll take a while.
Oh, okay. I'll wait.
After the war, I got married almost immediately to Millicent Kellogg, whose family had lived here. And I'd known her since before the war, and we got sort of engaged during the war. We got married immediately. I remember getting off the train at Millicent when I first got home. And she met me and said, well, we can get married either June 1st or June 15th. This was about the 15th of May. So I said June 15th. And I had to go do some things to get myself discharged.
Sure.
Which was funny because I had a temporary appointment as a second lieutenant. So to get me out of the service, they had revoked the temporary appointment. Which then I was a first lieutenant. And then I reverted to an enlisted rank of platoon sergeant, which was just a technicality thing.
That's right.
But then they had to discharge me. Whereas if I'd been an officer, they could have slid me into the reserve automatically.
Oh, I see.
So then they said, do you want to join the reserve? I said, yeah, I guess so. But then I looked at the thing and they said, you got my name spelled wrong on this. Do you want to? I said, can you correct it? I said, oh, no, it's got to go back to Washington to be corrected. You know, where the services are. So they sent me back the thing. By then I'd had a few weeks to think about it. I said, I don't want to be in the Marine Corps Reserve. So I didn't go to Korea.
No.
Anyhow, I got married, had a whole bunch of kids. Well, first worked in New York City at the New York Trust Company, in the Trust Department. I wanted to learn about investments. I worked there. We had a couple of kids and moved up to Pittsfield. I worked in a bank up there for 3 or 4 years. That seemed to be kind of a dead end, and I was a restless soul, so I came back down to Salisbury, where I went to work with Charlie Wonder, who was an Army colonel, retired, who lived in Salisbury, across from where my grandfather had lived. And Charlie was from Pittsburgh, and he was head of investment council business out there, and he had a house in Salisbury, so he opened up a little office there, which allowed him, I guess, probably the tax benefits. But we never developed a heck of a lot of business. That was kind of discouraging. The main reason I joined him was I sort of wanted to forestall him something getting started without my being involved with it. I was in the investment. I knew there wasn't room for very many people.
No.
Then I ran a brokerage office in Salisbury for a few years, or Lakeville. I rented some space from Bill Herrick and the Herrick Travel Service, Lakeville. It's still there, I think, under some name. I rented about half of that building, which Charlie Wonder had rented. I guess when I did that first rented a little tiny office in Al Borden's building, a little brown. I just had a single person office. I was in. I didn't even have a secretary. And did everything myself. I worked for a brokerage firm from some guy I'd known him. Oh, it was a connection of mine at Yale. I didn't really know him that well. Then that firm went broke, and I got connected up with a Hartford brokerage firm. I worked as a stockbroker in Salisbury, in Lakeville, for a total of about 10 years, 71 or something. And I got pretty sick of it then, and things were changing in the brokerage business. They were cutting commissions. The firm I worked for in Hartford was an old firm that started in 1870. They sold out to an aggressive New York firm, and I knew they wouldn't want a tiny little office like the one I had. I quit, and it felt like playing Monopoly anyhow after a while. Then I had a relative die who left me some money, which was very nice. I put some of it aside for my kids' education to finish them up. I had five daughters by that time. And I went back to school at Teachers College in New York and got a degree in psychology. And fairly young, I must have been, I don't know what, it was 77 when I got it, so I was 53. Mm-hmm. Then I went to work. I worked for a while, 1 year in a state hospital out in Long Island, Central Islip, which had been a gigantic hospital.
Yes, I know.
At one point, it had 25,000 patients. When I was there, it was down to 3 or 4. It was really, they were discharging people like crazy, and they had new medication. Then I left. When I finished the internship, I went up. I got a job up in Hartford. Stayed there in the Hartford area from, say, 79 to 91 or so. And I practiced psychology up there, mainly out of Canton, so I had an office there, did independent practice. I'd come up to Salisbury quite a bit. We still had, I had a camp on Mount Rigner, because my grandfather had ended up with 14 acres. Somehow I got permission from a lot of elderly aunts and uncles to build a cabin on part of it. So I had a camp up there. My brother Donald had my father's cabin, which my father had had since 1921 or two. So I had that. It was nice. The kids went up there. There were all sorts of cousins up there, Wells and Brigades. Let's see.
All related.
All related. My grandmother was Harriet Electa Wells, who was, she was a cousin of Harry Wells, cousin Harry, who was, died a few years ago at the age of 102, Brewster. They were first cousins or something. So Harry's children were my father's second cousins. So they were from me, they were about my, ran about my age, but they were second cousins, once removed, because we were the different generation. Mm-hmm. Everybody called everybody cousin. They'd walk into my house, I remember Alfred Wells, a very polite fellow, he'd walk into the house and say, "How are you, cousin Lois?" He'd say to my father, my mother and cousin Don, you know, mm-hmm. and my father. Mm-hmm. Very old-fashioned.
Yeah. Right? Well, if you have completed what you wanted to say about your career, could we say something about the family?
Sure.
You know, because you are related.
Well, I did. Well, go ahead. I did move back here.
Uh huh.
I mean, after I finished, I retired more or less.
Yes.
In 91 or so, and then I went out to Oregon for about 6 years, thinking I'd retire out there in Eugene, which is a lovely town. But my kids thought it was too far away.
Oh.
So I decided to come back here. 98.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow.
And your family, then your immediate family, your daughters are all probably close enough
to
you.
More. One's in Boston, one Philadelphia, one in New York, one in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
One in Missouri. But they like to come back here because they grew up here.
Oh, they did. Well,
they like the cabin up on the lake. They've got cousins here. So it's,
mm-hmm. And now your father was a Warner, and his father was the man what they call Judge Warner, who acquired.
And my father was Donald Judson. His father was Donald Tickner. Warner, who was at that point when I knew the superior court judge, a long white beard, and he always used to give me peppermints. And he died in 29, I think. He got pneumonia or something in Washington, D.C. see he died. At a fairly ripe age, but he, he was a somewhere I heard this story, which it may be apocryphal, but apparently that he never shaved. When he went to college, he went to Trinity College as a young man, just after the end of the Civil War. I think he went in 1869. He went to Trinity College, and he wouldn't shave, and he got in all sorts of trouble there at Trinity from the, because at that time the fashion was, no, it changes all the time, the fashion was to be clean shaven.
And he never shaved.
He never shaved. I remember this long white beard. And I had a, some letters that my, brother got them transcribed or somebody, that he wrote home, or the family wrote him when he was in college. And he had a sister, Grace. I remember, he, most of the letters would be from his father or something. But this, we got one letter from his sister, Grace. Pa's got boils and he isn't feeling very good, but you know, generally he's pretty happy as long as he's got his chair by the fireplace and a barrel of cider in the cellar.
I think we'll turn over to the other side now. And you say
I think
along right, many generations.
I think right after the revolution.
Really?
They have been, they've been in the, well, that's, there's a genealogy, I think, in the library or something.
I'm sure it is.
Andrew Warner was the original ancestor who moved. He came to Hartford area in the 1600s, and he wandered around, died in Belchertown, Massachusetts.
The Warner who was the judge, and that was your grandfather?
My grandfather.
Your grandfather.
And his father was also a Donald Warner. He was, I mean, they went Donald Judson, which was my great-grandfather, Donald Tickner, which was my grandfather.
And
Donald
your
Judson was my father, and Donald Tickner was my brother. My brother said when he retired, there had been 140 years where somebody named Donald Warner had practiced law in the area.
Now this grandfather is the one who started the property up on Mount Rushmore.
No, I think I think it may have been my great grandfather. They bought it around before my great grandfather died.
Okay. Now you say your mother was a Scoville.
Just to get my father's family a little bit more.
Go right ahead.
My great grandmother was Lois Camp Tickner Ball. It was a Ball family that had a farm up on the Under Mountain Road, the Ball Farm, which there's an old house in there. It used to belong to a guy named Gillette. This is something my father used to tell me is probably the oldest dwelling in Salisbury. But anyhow, and the Ball family lived there. And Lois Camp Tickner Ball was of that family. But her family was quite big, and she'd been adopted by her uncle, Benajah Tickner, whose family, there were a couple of brothers, Luther Tickner, I think practiced in Sharon, and another Tickner. They were doctors. And Benajah got to be a doctor and was a Navy surgeon and went on a tremendous trip in the 1820s by sailboat in the Navy all the way around to the China Sea. And it was the U.S. government was, after the War of 1812, was making a position that they were not going to be shut out of anywhere by the British.
Well,
that's how we're related to Tickners.
Yes, that name comes up in your family a great deal.
There was a Luther Tickner, and then the Benajah Tickner, another brother.
And this was on your
father's side.
Father's side.
My great great grandmother was a niece and ward of Benajah Tickner. I got a call from this guy, Benajah, kept diaries of his trip. There was a book that was published by University of Michigan Press about maybe 10 years ago, The Voyage of the Peacock, which was the name of the boat that he was on.
Oh, really?
And I had a call.
Go ahead.
I had a call from a guy out in Michigan where Benajah Tickner had lived. There's now his old homestead out there is a cobblestone farm in Ann Arbor, which is apparently sort of an historical place, you know, like a lot of, like the Holly House in Lakeville. It's kept up as a historical place, which is just kind of interesting.
And he had heard of you through a connection in the family. Yeah.